From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today is the 50th anniversary of the Polk Awards. Who was George Polk? We'll take a look at his life and the death of the legendary CBS journalist killed as he tried to meet with a rebel leader during the Greek Civil War. And a look at why 1,500 coal miners die from black lung disease a year unnecessarily. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Kosovo is taking a pounding in the latest round of NATO attacks. There were reportedly 30 strikes on the southern province overnight. They continued well into the daylight hours, and Serb media in Pristina say the city's bus station and an airport were targeted. The Serbs also say NATO hit a hydroelectric power plant and a major food processing factory early today. And there are signs the strikes are starting to affect basic food supplies. The first known report of food rationing in Yugoslavia has surfaced since the start of the Allied air campaign 3 weeks ago. The Washington Post is reporting Yugoslav forces raided a village in northern Albania and fought an hour-long skirmish with Albanian troops, stoking fears the Kosovo conflict could spill into neighboring Balkan countries and drawing stern warnings from the United States. The incident adds to tensions in a volatile region already thrown into turmoil by 3 weeks of NATO bombing against Yugoslavia that is about to escalate again. The Clinton administration is poised to send more warplanes to the Balkans and to call up more reserves. Several hundred volunteers from Air National Guard units already are part of the air campaign. But with NATO commanders asking for 300 more U.S. warplanes, Defense Secretary William Cohen is preparing a request for more reservists, a request the White House expects to receive shortly. Meanwhile, the administration is about to present Congress with a bill. Pentagon officials say the request for emergency funding to cover the cost of Operation Allied Force will likely be $3 to $4 billion. Congressional officials say it may be closer to $5 billion. German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder said today only the complete withdrawal of Yugoslav troops and police from Kosovo will bring an end to the NATO airstrikes. He was addressing the European Union's parliament in Strasbourg only hours before EU leaders were due to meet United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan in Brussels to discuss diplomatic initiatives to try to contain the conflict in the Serbian province of Kosovo. Annan will brief the 15 leaders on a five-point plan aimed at restoring peace to the province, which has a predominantly ethnic Albanian population. Meanwhile, Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer said that problems remained to win Russia over to a German plan to end the Kosovo conflict, although differences between Moscow and the West had narrowed. The German foreign minister told reporters Russia still has a series of major problems over the makeup of a peacekeeping force. Moscow was also concerned over whether it would be unacceptable to Belgrade to deploy foreign troops in Kosovo. UN prosecutors have indicted Serb paramilitary leader Arkan with at least three categories of war crimes, including crimes against humanity, this according to court documents released today. Chief Prosecutor Louise Arbour said on March 31st that Zeljko Raznicevic, alias Arkan, was named on a sealed indictment that dated from September 97. She gave no details of the charges at the time, but said she's serving an arrest warrant to Yugoslavia. In Pontiac, Michigan, supporters and opponents of Dr. Jack Kevorkian are debating the sentence handed down for the assisted suicide advocate. Kevorkian was sentenced yesterday to serve 10 to 25 years for second-degree murder in the death of a Lou Gehrig's patient. An Oregon-based Right to Die group says the sentence will reignite a national argument over euthanasia. A spokeswoman for the Hemlock Society says Kevorkian was acting with compassion when he gave a terminally ill patient a lethal dose of drugs. Kenneth Starr is saying no to future independent counsels. Starr will testify before a Senate committee today that the statute will give him the power to investigate President Clinton should not be renewed. In testimony prepared for today's hearing, Starr says the independent counsel law violates the Constitution's separation of the judicial and executive branches. And in New York, the union representing the city's police officers, the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, cast a vote of no confidence in Police Commissioner Howard Safer yesterday, questioning many of his actions in recent months and saying that officers are under tremendous pressure to make arrests and issue summonses. This comes as community organizers plan for a major march tomorrow in Brooklyn to Manhattan to protest the killing of the Guinean immigrant Amadou Diallo by police officers. Tens of thousands are expected. Meanwhile, his parents are on a 16-city tour around the United States to denounce police brutality. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners around the country.
Well, Juan, today is the 50th anniversary of the Polk Awards, and today we're going to talk about just who George Polk was, how he died, and what information we have about that death. But before we do that, last night in the pre-Polk Awards ceremony, there was a discussion about the importance of war correspondence today. And I got a chance to catch the tail end of it. It was at the Newseum in New York, which is a part of the Freedom Forum. And Christiane Amanpour, the CNN correspondent, was speaking. I believe she was speaking from Belgrade and having a dialogue with the reporters in the audience by satellite. So at the end of the discussion, I got a chance to ask her a question. Now, I'm sure a lot of people around the country listening would like to ask Christiane Amanpour a question, but I asked her if she agrees with the policy of her network and the other networks of putting retired military generals, putting these military analysts on payroll for the networks to get their point of view. I mean, certainly the Pentagon and NATO are putting in a tremendous amount of effort to get their word out anywhere they can. Why do the networks have to pay for that point of view? And I then asked her that even if she supports it, would she also support putting anti-war activists on the payroll so that when we have these generals sitting in the CNN, ABC, NBC, CBS studios continually talking about this issue of should we escalate from airstrike to ground war, shouldn't we also have people like Noam Chomsky sitting there as well?
Well, of course, for most journalists, the toughest job is being reporting on a war in which your own country is involved. You know, as Danny DeVito used to talk about other people's money. Well, it's easy to deal with other people's wars. It's a lot harder to deal with a war your own government is involved in and report on it accurately.
That's right. But I do think there are some serious questions about the level of the cheerleading that we're seeing and the lack of opening for other points of view. Now, Christian,
so by the way, what did she answer?
She said... we're open to all points of view. People should just call the networks and say they want to be included, too. And she did point out, she said, look, it, not only CNN has to fill 24 hours of news, but right now, basically 24 hours of reporting on the strike against Yugoslavia. So they're looking for information. But now I wasn't allowed to take the mic back. But given that they are seeking more information, you would think, or points of view, that they would be opening up these microphones at a time when, I don't know, it seems to me it's more unprecedented than ever, or it's just a continuum from Grenada to Panama to the Iraq War to now of just seeing this military hardware show with the generals there as the describers of the nuts and bolts of each new weapon system that's introduced into Yugoslavia. And I think there is a very serious question here about journalism. It really highlights it at times like these.
Well, I was pleasantly surprised yesterday to see at least Dan Rather actually interviewing Serbs and ordinary Serbs and asking them and letting them go on for a while about how their feelings were about the continued bombing. But I think that, as always, the mass media in this country always falls short, very much turn into cheerleaders in time of war.
Yeah, and it's a serious question. Larry King of CNN has this policy of, it's interesting, they are putting Serb TV commentators and other spokespeople on, but then what they do is they sort of cut them off the satellite and they have five people, you know, slam them, tear them apart. While I applaud them putting other points of view on, I also think it's important that they have a dialogue, something that's not happening in this bombing. But it's not just these government positions, what many might say are war criminals on both sides, but it is the people, the organizers, the activists, the leading intellectual dissidents in this country that have a very different point of view than Clinton, than Milosevic, than NATO, etc. And they've got to get in there as well. Well, I think George Polk would probably agree if he were alive today. And today we're going to talk about just who this man was. Just weeks after CBS correspondent George Polk was murdered in Greece while he was covering the country's civil war, his peers created the George Polk Award to honor the best in American journalism. But Polk would have been bitterly disappointed had he known that the best in American journalism accepted, largely without protest, an investigation into his death in which evidence was not only ignored but manufactured to convict innocent men, an investigation in which politics played a bigger role than truth. On Sunday, May 16, 1948, a boatman discovered George Polk's body floating in the Bay of Salonika in northern Greece. He'd been shot in the back of the head at point-blank range. The Greek government declared that it would spare no effort to find the murderer. The United States, which was spending $1 million a day to help the conservative Greek regime suppress a communist rebellion, promised to monitor the investigation closely. Well, the list of possible suspects was long. Polk had relentlessly criticized both sides in the war. While he had called the communist guerrillas thugs, he'd also accused the Greek government of corruption and blasted Washington for supporting the repressive right-wing regime. Well, right now, we are joined by a number of people who are very close to this story. We're joined by a man who's just written a book on George Polk. Elias Vlantin is with us, and with Zach Metker, he wrote the book Who Killed George Polk? The Press Covers Up a Death in the Family. Elias Vlantin has been deeply involved in U.S.-Greek relations. He's an authority on U.S. government archives on Greece and has published in The Nation, The Village Voice, and a number of other publications. We're also joined from southern France by George Polk's younger brother, William Polk. William Polk was very close to his brother, also professor of history at Harvard University and head of the Middle Eastern Studies Department at the University of Chicago. He, too, is completing a book on the Polk family. And in our studio, we're joined by another of George Polk's relatives, his cousin, Bill Price. He was a journalist with the New York Daily News, like you, Juan, when George Polk was killed in Greece. The Daily News fired him, though, in 1955 when he refused to testify before the Senate Internal Security Committee, which was inquiring into communist influences in the press. Well, we're going to start off by looking at George Polk's murder on that day, May 16th, 1948, and the investigation and cover-up that ensued. Elias Vlantin, can you put it in a nutshell for us? And I hate to say it that way, but can you describe first how George Polk was found and then what happened here in the United States?
Well, he was based in Athens, and he was planning a trip with his wife and a couple of colleagues, a vacation in northern Greece. At the last minute, no one was able to go with him, so he decided to go to northern Greece by himself. He was going to go to a certain city, Kavala, that the airport was flooded in that city, so he ended up in Salonika, which was probably 20 or 30 miles from the Greek guerrillas in the mountains. So it was very close to the actual Greek Civil War. As you sort of said in your introduction, he he had a lot of respect on the part of his colleagues, but he also had a lot of enemies in the area. He had criticized the communists. He had criticized the government, the Greek government. He had criticized the American aid program. He had criticized the British and had had difficulties with the British elsewhere in the Middle East. He was in Salonika about 36 hours when he disappeared. And for the first couple of days, the assumption was that perhaps he had slipped out to interview the guerrilla leader Marcos in the mountains. A week after his disappearance, his body was discovered floating in the Bay of Salonika. The Greek government rather quickly said this sort of fits the work of the communists. There's no doubt he was going to the mountains, and the communists killed him. And groups of journalists in Washington and in New York set about to find out what really happened to George Polk.
And for those of our listeners around the country who don't know much about the Greek Civil War, could you give us, in a nutshell, how important was that war in terms of U.S. foreign policy, and how closely was it being watched around the world?
It was, without exaggeration, it was the most important early post-war battle, Cold War battle, between the United States and its allies, and the Soviet Union and its allies. Conflicts that we could, talk about a dozen others. Subsequently, it was really a civil war within the country, with its was created from indigenous causes, and yet the larger powers wanted to exploit it for their own geopolitical aims. In 1947, this sort of policy reached its high point with President Truman, where he said Greece is being attacked externally by the communists, and we will do whatever is necessary to defeat them. The United States started pouring $1 million a day into Greece, most of which went to military aid, and the Greek government, that had been rather brutal toward its population to begin with, became even more so. And the United States, feeling that it had no alternative, largely tolerated that brutality and oppression. And of course, as we know, the United States, quote, won in Greece, the communists were defeated, and that actually became the model for U.S. intervention abroad up through Vietnam. And, Vietnam was considered, we defeated the Greek guerrillas, in 1949, and we were going to defeat the Vietnamese guerrillas in the 60s. And, of course, it didn't quite work out that way.
And very briefly, how would you connect what we were looking at politics in Greece and the U.S. connection to it then to the current Balkan crisis? Is there a connection?
Well, there's I think it would be easier to talk about how the reporting has changed, perhaps. People like Polk and the sort of first generation of post-war foreign correspondents were people who lived in countries of the region. They couldn't sort of fly into a crisis. They had to be there. They had less contact with their home offices than you do now, so therefore they tended to be much more independent. They tended to be people who were freelance writers first and then just hooked on to an affiliation when they got to the area. So they largely could call their own shots, and they could largely, if they wanted to, and Polk did, call it like they saw it. I think that era largely ended by the 1950s, partly as a consequence of the Polk case. And now you sort of get, as you were talking about in your introduction, people coming on who are experts either on military or whatever, but who largely have maybe never been to the area, don't know the region, and don't really empathize with the people living there. A lot of Polk, you could sort of summarize it as sort of little guy journalism, is the average person. How does this policy, forget, going to the embassy and getting the official statement, that's very nice and part of the story, but what to the Greek peasants in a village did the military aid program really mean? Or, you know, the communist insurgency. Those were the questions that he and a number of his colleagues were really gripped with.
Elias Valentin, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. But when we come back, we are going to take a look at the heart of not only your book's thesis, but also what the family has felt for a long time and many other journalists as well, that George Polk was the victim of two crimes, the first murder, then abandonment by CBS and the American news establishment, which exceeded in Greece's official frame-up and preposterous trial of absent communists as his killers. And we'll look at the role of the United States and the Central Intelligence Agency in George Polk murder investigation. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we look at the life and death of George Polk. Our guests are Elias Valentin. He is author of the book Who Killed George Polk? The Press Covers Up a Death in the Family, as well as two family members whose connection to George Polk go beyond bloodlines. William Price is with us, who ultimately was fired from the New York Daily News because of a communist witch hunt there and kind of red baiting that was going on, not just kind of. And also we're joined from the south of France by George Polk's brother, William Polk. He was his younger brother, professor of history at Harvard University and head of the Middle Eastern Studies Department at the University of Chicago. He's written a lot of books, including The Elusive Peace, The Arab World, and is currently writing a book on George Polk and the murder as well. Let's go to William Polk, the younger brother of George Polk. This issue of George Polk being a victim not only of murder, but of the American news establishment. Can you lay that out for us?
I think you'd do better actually asking William Price about that, because he's a journalist and I'm not. But let me say just a couple of words about that, from my own experience. I think the difficult problem at the time was that the working press, as we all tried to describe it, wanted to have some sort of an independent investigation. And the American government policy at the time was to get this issue over with and go on with the job of winning the war in Greece. And there was the same kind of hostility to independent journalism at that time that there later was in Vietnam. The desire was just to put the whole issue behind us and get on with a really serious matter of winning the war. And those people who were active at the time in trying to find out what was happening had in various ways a great deal of pressure brought to bear on them to be quiet and let the issue slowly go away.
Well, Bill Price, what about that pressure, and what is your sense of how the journalists here in this country dealt with his murder?
As soon as we had heard about the killing of George Polk, a number of us got together. I and was covering United Nations at Lake Success, was then in Lake Success at that point, with a woman named Marcella Hitchmanova, who had been a friend of George Polk's in Cairo. And she came into our daily news office there at the United Nations and asked if I'd heard about George Polk. And And I said, well, he hasn't been around, has he? And he said, well, he's missing. And I, oh, well, that's all right. He'll show up. Don't worry. He's got that kind of comeback. And she said, no, he's been gone now for 9 days. By this time, he's dead. And at that point, we took it seriously, and we realized that something had to be done. And we called meetings at that point of the United Nations Correspondents Association and started talking about it. And we set up a sort of a working committee to do something about it. And out of that came what we called the Newsmen's Commission to investigate the murder of George Polk. I ended up as the secretary treasurer of that group. But a lot of people were also involved. But we represented what I would call, what we might say, the working press, as opposed to the committee set up by Walter Lippmann, who was certainly the represented the people that ran the owned and ran the papers, the publishers and the editors. So I think that there was that kind of distinction, because at one point we thought, listen, everybody would be, we're so angry, everybody is so angry, we should be together and demanding a full investigation. So some of us went down to Washington and talked to Walter Lippmann, and he said, no, get out of here. Well, he didn't say it that way, but he said, no, I don't think we'll take care of it, don't worry.
And for our younger listeners, Bill Price, the significance of Walter Lippmann.
Walter Lippmann, depending on how you looked at it, he was the agent of the State Department, what most of us thought, because nobody really knew whether he was reporting what the State Department was doing or that he was telling them what to do. but anyway, he ran a column in the Herald Tribune and then later in the New York Times, which was known in the world, I guess, as the top commentator of New York foreign policy matters and so forth. And so we went down and realized that was the first time that we realized that we were up against a something which was we had never figured out, that we would have to deal with the fact that there would be people running the government who would not be anxious to have other people around looking into things which would might embarrass a government which was an ally of the United States, in which we were sending monies, many monies to them over there in Athens, and this is the Greek government. So we didn't we very quickly understood that there was a distinction between the people who were going to be concerned about the George Polk case. Our thing was, I think we were really, honestly, as far as we could take it, we wanted to really wanted to set up a way in which we could identify what had happened and that George got killed. And the other thing, the other part that was eventually carried on by Walter Lippmann and the people around his committee, essentially just echoed the position of the Greek government, which was then also the State Department office here. So we had a very immediate, at the very beginning, had that kind of difference of opinion.
And in the Lippmann Commission that supposedly investigated the murder was also James Reston, who is a columnist today as well.
Yes. Okay. That represented that whole group of people. I think it's something that if when you're a working newspaper man, at least we were then what we called the leg men, that we worked used our legs to go and cover a story. We walked over. We were the leg men on a job, whereas the editors had their desk jobs, and it was that kind of thing to look at it that way. You could see it that way, We very soon realized that there was a two different kind of way. This is what kept the Lippmann alive, and I think maybe in partly in opposition to us. And our Newsmen's Commission, which had to do it on our own, and we started.
Elias Blanton, you describe very well in Who Killed George Polk, the press covers up a death in the family, what these sort of parallel groups were investigating, the Littman Commission and then the journalists like Bill Price, who were investigating, knowing they weren't going to get the truth from the other commission, working closely with Wild Bill Donovan. Who is he? And then we're going to go to Howard K. Smith, our listeners, longtime and older listeners know Howard K. Smith for many years, a newsman at CBS and ABC. In fact, he was George Polk's boss, and he wanted to replace George Polk covering the Greek Civil War, but CBS wouldn't let him. And Elias Blanton, you lay out in the book an interesting thesis about why.
Well, Howard K. Smith wanted to investigate the murder of George Polk, and he was based in London, and he had been to Greece before. He had actually done quite a bit of reporting from there. He felt it was his obligation as his superior, and he was sort of earnestly wanting to look at the truth. Instead, CBS chose a Winston Burdett, who was based in Rome and was a much less competent reporter. And although they told Smith that the reason he couldn't go was because he had other assignments, he in fact came back to the U.S. and was given a three-week vacation, which covered all the time that Burdett was in Athens. The Libman Committee, to talk about General Donovan, had first they became frustrated that there was no progress in the investigation. With the State Department, agreed to have General Wild Bill Donovan, who had been head of the Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the CIA, to go and investigate the Polk murder. It's very clear from the documents, and he actually had a Greek-American Air Force colonel investigate on his behalf. It's very clear from the documentation that at some point Donovan realized this just needed to be wrapped up. And he told the Greek authorities in a meeting that, quote, an arrest is desired. And sure enough, the Greek authorities satisfied him, and a couple of weeks later arrested Gregory Stoktopoulos, a Greek journalist, tortured him for 6 weeks, and made him confess to things he had not done. There were other points at which the Libman Committee sort of went to the brink, did the right thing. They had Stoktopoulos' confessions analyzed, for example. But then when the evidence came back that contradicted their assumptions that a fair investigation would occur, they never pursued them. And they were, much as Bill Price eloquently put it, to much more closely identified with U.S. foreign policy and with the Washington establishment.
Howard K. Smith, you were a foreign correspondent, as was just described. You also covered World War II and the Nuremberg trials for CBS and then went on to ABC. Now, George Polk was known specifically for investigating the corruption and brutality of the Greek regime, a right-wing regime, for being very critical of the United States under the Truman Doctrine, fortifying the Greek regime with $300 million in foreign aid. Did you share that point of view, and was that why CBS wouldn't let you take his place and continue that kind of coverage?
I shared that viewpoint. I broadcast it also from Athens from time to time. And one of the vice presidents at CBS told me the reason I was not assigned to follow the investigation was that, he said, in his words, there's room for another corpse in Salonika Bay, and you sound like you're a candidate, so you better stay away from there. And so they sent someone else, and they said that also flatteringly said that they needed my broadcast. So I had to stay at work. I think the big thing that happened, the cosmic change that occurred, was a sea change in American attitudes towards the world. I think after World War II, we were prepared to go back into somewhat less vicious isolationism, but we felt the world would be taken care of by the great powers of the past. And then when President Truman realized we had to take a stand and announced that we were going to be very active in world affairs, the attitude of American diplomats changed. Previous to that, they thought the Greek government that George Polk was covering was just as bad as he said it was, and it was very corrupt. But after it became our responsibility, suddenly it became rather unpatriotic to criticize the Greek government. And I think the fact that the American diplomatic community turned against his viewpoint may have given an incentive to the right-wingers to get rid of him. I think that was the big change that he was a victim of.
And Howard K. Smith, do you think that subsequent to that, in the failures of the of journalists in this country to adequately monitor the investigation, did this have any lasting impact on American journalism and how journalists did their job or do their job overseas?
Well, I was the chief European correspondent for CBS. Ed Murrow appointed me to succeed him. I did not notice that change you're talking about. I did notice a growing disinterest in foreign affairs when the Cold War became rather tiresome to the American public. But I don't think there was any timidity on the part of journalists about being independent. I think that we were quite independent and quite openly said so.
Well, Bill Price, I assume you have a different point of view. You ultimately were driven out of the business. Explain what happened to you.
Several years later, I was subpoenaed by the Senate Committee, Senate's Internal Security Committee, headed by James Eastland, Senator James Eastland, and refused to cooperate with him. And the Daily News, who were my employer at the time, didn't appreciate that and fired me while I was on the train coming home.
What were they looking for? Why'd they call you? And what did the Daily News then say to you?
I could never really figure out, and I don't think they knew either, but they were just, it was on a wild goose straight. But they picked out me because of very little things that I think I had signed a petition to save the Rosenbergs, and things like that, which put me in somebody's book as a non-wanted person, and especially was true with the people of the Daily News. I wore out my welcomer, I guess.
I.F. Stone, a well-known journalist, muckraker, crusader for the pursuit of truth in journalism, he took up George Polk's case as well and would not relent.
Yes, he did. He wrote a series of articles for, I think it was a PM magazine, newspaper, and he was very good on it. And I would say not only him, but one of the important people in this is Iselias Blanton, because he kept on this case from the very beginning. It was long before he wrote the book. He had written a magazine article in a magazine called More, which kept alive the concerns that people were having, not just out of the support of George Polk, but because of the things that were happening around the refusal really to have a real investigation. So that I think that Elias should be congratulated for being one of the people that kept us alive. I think one of the interesting things is why, after all this 50 years, there is still this interest in the George Polk case. I think it probably was part of our work in the Newsmen's Commission, at least, was we got the word out. And we sent out massive mailings and things like that, which said there is a problem here. And it was against, and I think a lot that went to the, essentially our result was, I mean, the people we went to were the newspapers themselves and the newspaper people.
Well, Elias Blanton, could you, in your book, you reach a conclusion that differs from some people in terms of what actually happened. What was the cause of Polk's death? Could you summarize that for us?
Sure. People have sort of up till my book come to about three or four conclusions. One, the communists killed him. That was the original conclusion. Two, the Greek government killed him. Three, the British killed him. And four, there was a theory in Greece that the CIA was involved and had killed him. What happened to me I started in the 70s and was still writing in the 90s. What happened to me in the late 80s was one day I sat down and said to myself, you know, there's an assumption that everyone has made, and that is that whoever carried out the cover-up actually carried out the murder. And the cover-up is very clear, that the Greek government, with the connivance of foreign powers, you know, perpetrated this fraud on the world. That's heavily documented. That's proven. But I said to myself, you know, maybe no matter what had happened to George Polk, these forces would have tried to exploit it for political purposes, given that in the late 40s, everything was being exploited for political purposes. So therefore, I said, it actually doesn't mean anything that the Greek government perpetrated the cover-up. So I went back to all my original sort of sources and documents and looked at things and did some investigation in Greece. And to me, and I'm sort of in my book say this is what I think the best case scenario is, although, you know, it's clearly unproven so late after the fact, and that is that Polk probably went to Salonika, had heard, as were rife at the time, lots of rumors about the stealing of American aid funds and the embezzling and trading with the guerrillas, selling American weapons to the guerrillas, all of which may or may not have been true, but he sort of knew about it. He was a good journalist. This was a great story, that there were drug smugglings, the guerrillas were selling drugs and getting weapons in return. So he went to Salonika and started to investigate. When he was there, a group of sort of thugs on the waterfront very quickly, in an impromptu act, decided that he knew more than he should and decided to kill him.
Elias Vlant, and when we come back from our break, we're going to hear a different theory of what actually what happened to George Polk from his brother. Elias Vlant is the author with Zat Mecker of Who Killed George Polk? The Press Covers Up a Death in the Family. We've also been joined by Howard K. Smith, longtime CBS and ABC newsman who is George Polk's boss, and we thank you for having joined us. Bill Price is with us in the studio, who is the cousin of George Polk and ultimately lost his job as a result of the McCarthy era. And we will go back to southern France when we return with George Polk's brother. After that, we'll speak with one of the George Polk Award winners this year, who investigated why so many coal miners every year, this in 1999, are continuing to die of black lung. Stay with us here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
If the earth could fly away, could you see her flying straight through space and time, leaving all humankind behind? If she could fly away, if she could fly away, so far away. If the earth could run away, could you see her gathering all the trees and plants, all the animals, all the birds and fowl, every creeping thing? They have never been her foe, never harmed her blessed soul. If she could run away, if she could run away, so far.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Today, the 50th anniversary of the George Polk Awards, honoring a young man. He was 34 when he died, George Polk, who died on his way to see a Greek guerrilla leader during the Greek Civil War. He died in May of 1948. His brother, William Polk, is with us from southern France. William Polk, while Bill Donovan railed against you when you started asking some serious questions, why, for example, the right wing was never suspected or accused, he said, "Don't you understand we're in the middle of a war?" He said, "You're a smart young man from a good family. If you keep on, you'll ruin your career." Well, you have continued to ask those questions, but you have taught at Harvard and at the University of Chicago. Where have those questions, what answers have those questions brought you?
I think the two questions that you have before you are who actually killed my brother, and secondly, what did it mean? What did the whole case mean? The first one is still a murky issue. We don't know exactly what happened. There are various theories. Mr. Vlanton has one that I don't personally think is correct, but it's one of several. But the more important question, it seems to me, is what the effect was on journalists. And the central purpose that I think my brother would have wanted to pursue is that it must not be allowed for journalists to be put in the firing line because, well, Howard K. Smith says that many of them will keep on doing their job, a certain number of them won't. And I believe very strongly, and I know my brother did, that if we can't rely on people to follow the leads of journalism wherever they go and whoever's feet get stepped on, then this is a very dangerous thing for a free society. And therefore, it's very important. We felt at the time, and I still feel, that those who tried to silence him not succeed in that purpose, that what he stood for be kept before us, and that the case itself be investigated fully and not be allowed completely to die without a resolution. And that, I think, is the central issue.
And what do you think happened to your brother ultimately?
Well, ultimately, of course, he was killed.
I know, but who do you think killed him?
I think that the supposition is very strong that the people who were very worried about what he was doing were people on the extreme right wing in Greek politics. It's a complicated story to get into fully, but Greece was, of course, involved in a civil war, and both the extremes of the left and the right had pretty well destroyed the center, and at that time, Greece was moving toward a dictatorship once again, under the patronage of the British. And those who questioned what was happening in Greece were asking or were putting forward issues that nobody on the right or the British government or the American government really wanted to face. We were in a situation, as has often been pointed out in Greece, not unlike Vietnam. We had to believe, we as a government in America had to believe, that the Greek government was a democratic, purposeful organization that was fighting for freedom. And those who questioned that were destroying the basis on which our aid program, among other things, was given. And there was great worry that if the case was not shut up fairly quickly, that the aid program might be called into question and our whole policy on Greece might be called into question. That was the reason for a great deal of pressure being put on me and various other people not to pursue what we were trying to find out.
Well, I want to thank you very much for staying with this story and investigating your brother's death. We look forward to reading your book. Also want to thank Elias Vlanton, who's been with us, author of Who Killed George Polk? The Press Covers Up a Death in the Family. And thank you very much to Bill Price, who came in today to talk about his cousin's death and also to talk about what it meant to pursue that to the end and ultimately to get driven out of the business, out of the newsroom. And we thank you all for being with us. If our listeners, if you want a copy of today's program, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And we're going to end today's program by moving forward 50 years to today, the 50th anniversary of the George Polk Awards, to speak with one of the George Polk Award winners, following in the tradition of crusading reporting, investigating governments and why people die. We're joined right now by a journalist from the Louisville Courier Journal, who has been investigating why so many coal miners die every year. His series is called Dust, Deception, and Death, Trying to Regulate the Mines. And he is Gardner Harris. Thanks for being with us, Gardner.
You're welcome.
Well, why do 1,500 coal miners a year die in 1999?
The question is important because the cause of the disease is so clear. It's breathing coal dust too much for too many years. And there's been laws on the books for more than 30 years that should have reduced the amount of coal dust in mines to the point where miners don't get black lung. They're still getting it. So we wondered why. And we found that the reason is, obviously, that they're breathing too much coal dust, that their bosses don't want to spend the money that it takes to reduce the dust levels in the mines to the point where their men will be safe. And we also found that the operators, helped by the miners themselves, cheat on coal dust tests so that their dust levels can be hidden from the government. We also found that the government has known about this cheating for 20 years and more and has done little about it. So that it's this sort of terrible situation for miners, because they feel like if they want to work and if they want to have a relatively good-paying job, there are a few of those in Appalachia, then they're forced to work under conditions that they know will eventually kill them.
So that's why how do they aid the mine operators themselves?
Well, they know that the dust levels are very high, much higher than is allowed by law. And they also know that the tests are being cheated. In fact, they help cheat the tests because their bosses expect them to. Hundreds of miners told me that if they didn't cheat the tests, they would be fired and they would be blacklisted from the industry. So they know exactly what's going on. They feel powerless to stop it.
Now, you did, in your series, you did a computer analysis of 24,380 federal dust records. What were you looking for in that analysis, and how did that help you reach your conclusions?
Actually, we analyzed something close to 3 million of them, but what we did was every couple of months, mine operators have to test their mine air for the level of dust. And they've been doing this for 28 years or so. And so we wanted to just look at what those test results say. And what we found is that what's extraordinary about this cheating is that it's been going on so long and is so routine that operators don't actually put much effort into it. So that if you look at the results of these dust tests, you find that the most common result of these dust tests is a level of dust so low that you could find that level on the street corner. And it's not possible for an operating mine to reduce dust that low. So that you can tell just by looking at the test results that this test is fraudulent. And for 25, 26 years, somewhere between 12% and 21% of all the tests taken underground have this vanishingly small amount of dust in them, which again proves that they were not taken correctly, that they were cheated. We had one expert who said that these dust test results are everything is possible in science, so it's possible that they could be accurate, but at the same time it's possible that skyscrapers could hop if molecules all moved at the same time. I mean, it just doesn't happen.
You write, Gardner Harris, about the U.S. Mine Safety and Health Administration. Can you talk about this agency that's supposed to be overseeing all of this? And does it have direct connections to the mine operators?
There is actually a fellow named David McAteer who heads up what's called MSHA now. And he was an advocate for miners for many years. I think most people have a pretty good opinion of David McAteer. But if you look at the sort of institutional history of MSHA, of course, they've been taking these dust test results for 30 years. They've been logging them into their computer. They had to know that the vast majority of these test results were simply fraudulent. And we found that there were reports being sent to MSHA time and time again, warning the agency that these test results were bogus, that the whole program was a fraud, and the agency did nothing about it. And it's only recently that David McAteer has decided, in part because of our series, has decided to start looking at mines that send so many of these obviously bogus test results to the government.
Well, Gardner, the United Mine Workers Union has a reputation as one of the more progressive unions in the American labor movement. Richard Trumka, who came out of that reform movement, is now the number two person at the AFL-CIO. What's been the union's role in either going after these violations or turning its head? Where's the union been in all this?
Well, first of all, we also had a story that showed that these obviously fraudulent test results are much less common in union mines than they are in non-union mines. The union is obviously very concerned about this, and it and one of the reasons they're concerned is that in order to keep a mine safe, in order to keep the dust levels low, you have to spend a good amount of money on labor to put up curtains, to do all the things that you need to do to keep dust down. Union mines do this much better than non-union mines, which is probably one of the reasons why union mines are going out of business at a much more rapid rate than non-union mines. The industry is increasingly non-union. The union believes that the reason for that is that they demand that conditions be kept safe. Non-union mines, the conditions are not. The dust is much higher, they contend, at the non-union mines than they are at the union ones.
Well, let's begin, or let's end where you began, is looking at the number of black lung deaths. What actually happens to a person who has black lung disease?
Well, it's, you basically drown from your own mucus. Your lungs scar up to the point where they're no longer useful for transferring oxygen, and you either you either die of a heart attack or you just die a very slow drowning death.
And you suffer from the disease for many years before that you do.
Right, it's a chronic disease. There is no cure. In some cases, some miners have gotten double lung transplants, but you only survive usually about 2 years after one of those.
If people want to read your series, Dust, Deception, and Death, Trying to Regulate the Mines, Gardner Harris, where can they go on the web?
It's courier-journal.com.
That's courier-journal.com.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, coming up from Kentucky, and we will see you at the George Polk Awards today. Congratulations. And Juan, congratulations to you as well. You will be honored today.
Thank you, Amy. I think it's all the way around, right?
Right.
With you and Jeremy also.
That's right. And Dred Scott Keyes. And in the background, the documentary that is being honored, Democracy Now!, Drilling and Killing.
For oil money. Who killed my nation? For oil money.
Chevron, just like Shell, uses the military to protect its oil activities.
The policy for all embassies overseas to support American companies in their operations abroad and to, as far as possible, promote American exports.
Don't pollute my water. Don't destroy our mangrove forests. Don't devastate our ecology.
They drill and they kill.
And thank you so much to the listeners of Democracy Now! Who have made it possible to continue these kinds of investigations. And what an honor it is for Juan, for Jeremy and Dred and I, and I know for Gardner as well, to be able to follow in the tradition of George Polk. We'll let you know what happens today. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. One last comment. Chevron should allow Pacifica Radio into its news conferences. At this point, it has barred Pacifica twice from entering news conferences it has. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Special thanks to Rosalie Hoffman. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
But I know